There are a lot of definitions for the term sustainability, but Patricia DeMarco likes this one.
It's meeting the needs of today's people without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their own needs.
DeMarco is a university lecturer. She's worked on energy and research policy for decades. She hosts a radio program. She's also a member of the Forest Hills Borough Council. That's just outside of Pittsburgh. And now she's the author of a new book, Pathways to Our Sustainable Future, A Global Perspective from Pittsburgh. Through case studies, DeMarco uses Pittsburgh's grassroots environmental successes and the city's commitment to sustainable building and energy use to get at themes of transformation, including a shift from relying on fossil fuels that contribute to climate change to renewable energy, like solar and wind. I sat down recently with Patty DeMarco to talk about her book. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me on your show.
So why use Pittsburgh as an example for a global perspective on sustainability?
Well, Pittsburgh is at the juncture of the transition from the fossil economy to the renewable and sustainable economy. We're actually down in the trenches making it happen. And it's really difficult because when you talk about what are the best examples of sustainability, there are lots of sustainability books out there. You can find examples from the Netherlands and from Spain and from Germany and New York and California, and they take samplings from all over. But to look at a particular place in a particular time and actually talk in depth about what are the conflicts, what are the areas of intersection where new things are emerging, it's a very exciting perspective.
The book is in three sections, and the first is connecting with the living earth. So how do people get back in touch with nature, and why did you start with that concept?
Well, I started with the concept of the living earth because that is our life support system. If we don't have fresh air, you know, clean water, fertile ground, and the biodiversity of species on this planet, of which we are one part, we do not have a living system. What we require for our daily existence is priceless. And so when you connect people with nature, you're sending them back to their inherent self. I mean, people may remember going fishing with their grandpa, or they may remember going for walks in the woods with their dad or mother. And when you can help people remember that the living earth is really where we live, then it's easier to say, wouldn't it be too sad if we lose this?
Sounds a little bit like Rachel Carson to me.
Well, it should be.
you're a scholar. I know you're a scholar of Rachel Carson, the biologist and author of Silent Spring, of course. And there are a lot of Carson quotes in the book.
Yes.
And I was left with the impression that in some ways you're asking, you know, like, what would Rachel Carson do?
Well, not quite that intuitively, but really she was one of the first and most eloquent exponents of a biocentric ethic rather than a human-centered ethic, where the concept that every living thing has the right to exist was central to her work and her writing. And that has become a much more well-appreciated concept. I mean, there have been people from all over the world, especially the People's Congress from Cochabamba in 2010 in Chile, where the indigenous peoples came forward with the universal rights of the Mother Earth, which they brought to the Paris climate meetings in 2015.
Well, you write that facts and technology alone won't get people to act on climate change, but that it will also take empathy. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I don't think we have a technology problem in facing either climate change or global pollution from man-made materials. We really are facing an ethical challenge, a need to make a commitment to preserve what is essential for our life. Our life support system is dependent on the living earth being a functioning system. If we follow a path which we know now is compromising that capability, and we also know that there are things we can do right now that will improve the situation, choosing not to take the actions that will improve the situation is an ethical decision, not a technical decision. And the international implications, because those of us who are causing the problems the most are not experiencing the worst of it just yet. Those are happening in places where they often have not contributed to the problem, you know, island nations, people in the southern hemisphere that have not, you know, adopted highly fossil-based development.
when you talk about a transition from fossil fuels to renewables and the pollution, it makes a lot of people defensive, especially in this region, because many people depend on those industries for their livelihoods. You know, where's the empathy for them?
Well, there is a great deal of empathy for them. And one of the things that I've been most excited about is finding in this transition space that people can, in fact, find a new way forward that, you know, takes account of reinvesting in communities that are not going to be pursuing fossil industry forward. I'll give you an example, the Clean Power Plan, which I discussed in my book. The United Mine Workers demonstrated by the thousands with their sound truck and their uniform shirts and signs. We had, you know, a couple hundred environmental activists in their ragtag things pushing baby strollers and so forth in counterpoint.
You're talking about the EPA hearings that they held over the country, and they were in Pittsburgh,
And I went to those hearings and I listened and I stood on the corner and talked to the mine workers and the people who were in their cadre. You know, what they were concerned about is very pragmatic, practical things. If there are no people in the coal mining industry, who's going to pay for my pension? Who's going to pay for my benefits? What happens to the long, proud tradition, the culture of five generations of people? Is that just thrown away? And really, there were proposals in addition to the Clean Power Plan, which was under the EPA regarding fuel switching, but there were proposals for reinvesting in communities that were being disinvested by mining and recovering and reclaiming those lands. There were programs for retraining and even additional new training and new skill development. There were programs for protecting pensions and benefits. They never made it out of committee for debate. So it wasn't that they weren't contemplated, they were not acted upon. And when you look at the opportunities in that whole arena of development where there are more jobs and good-paying jobs in the renewable energy industries right now than there are in all of the fossil industries. One in every 50 jobs in America is in the renewable energy systems right now. That's without a deliberate promotion from the government level. That's happening because it makes sense.
Yeah. When you talk about Pittsburgh, I think people think about Pittsburgh, the city, this sort of blue democratic bubble. And then there are all these outlying communities, municipalities, small towns that are part of the Pittsburgh region, but not necessarily part of this thinking or, you know, feel included in this.
It's spreading out, though. I mean, I talk about the whole community-supported agriculture process, which connects many of those communities back into the city by bringing food back and forth. People are looking more and more at adapting these kinds of principles in outlying areas. And even since I finished writing this book, there's been a lot of forward motion in that direction. One of the things that frustrates me is that a book is a point in time, a little snapshot at a particular point of time, and everything keeps moving forward. I keep wanting updates and adding more material and adding more. You'll never finish, you know. You'll never finish because it's an ongoing process. But, for example, there are communities within an hour's drive of Pittsburgh that are reimagining their future, are building new approaches to municipal services. I mean, my borough is putting up a net zero energy borough building, and that would have never happened 10 years ago, you know. And because we're in Pittsburgh, you can model what happens when you do decide you're going to do a sustainable process. We have examples to look at. You know, the Hill District was at one time a cultural arts center of the city, and it was cut off by road expansion and expressways that made it easier for cars to get in and out of the city. And it is a traditionally Black neighborhood, and it really had fallen into disinvestment and depopulation. Out of that has come, you know, an interest in people wanting to help each other and really pull together a community of caring there, the Ujamaa Collective. You know, 17 women, you know, decided this isn't good for us. We're going to reinvest in our own community and started their own micro investment circle. They have a whole enterprise that has blown out of that and a 15-acre organic farm that feeds, you know, lots of people. This kind of thing happened out of sheer force of will and determination and just harnessing the resources they could get and drawing people toward it. None of these were centrally planned top-down administrative. These are things that happen when you're having a revolution. The progress happens in the cracks in the system that isn't working, and people find innovative ways forward that work for them. And so that you know, is gradually filtering out and out.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
You're welcome.
Patricia DeMarco is the author of Pathways to Our Sustainable Future, A Global Perspective from Pittsburgh. And we should say the book was funded by the W. Clyde and Ida Mae Thurman Foundation of the Pittsburgh Foundation. And the Allegheny Front has also received support from the Pittsburgh Foundation. There's more about the book and Patty DeMarco's work at AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.